Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time as the seasons pass, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network. In conjunction with Slick Enterprises, and we're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Slick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia. You can find us on the web at GridironGreatsMagazine.com. It is at this time I would like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, so good to be back on. Who else has has that credibility like I do? Red Grange and Steve Largent, all under one hat.
It is a very unique combination. However, it shows the breadth of the historical nature of your collection from its earliest beginnings to the modern-day game.
You're a gracious man, parts, Captain.
And parts in between. As I always say, there is never a wrong collection if you collect it. You can collect whatever you want, however you want. And as far as I'm concerned, if you enjoy it, that's all that matters. And that's really what it's all about.
Very good point.
Well, tonight,
I agree.
We have a wide open forum, and we're going to be talking about a lot of different things over the next 55 minutes or so. So we're going to lead off. I'm going to jump script here a little. I know you're going to get into something, but I just want to say first that the latest issue of Gridiron Greats is out. It's available. And I will start off immediately by saying, if you don't subscribe to Gridiron Greats, what are you waiting for? Well, we had a really good issue. I don't understand. And on a more somber note, before we have even another somber point, I'd like to express my condolences to the Burke family in San Diego, California, and the loss of their father and husband, John J. Burke III, who was an original subscriber to Gridiron Greats magazine. I just found out over the past few weeks he passed at a relatively young age, in his 70s. And again, I like to express my sympathies. Great guy. Had some correspondence with him over the years. And again, my sympathies to the family. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. Let's get started.
Obviously, a very sad passing, and in the Green Bay Packer world happened. Paul Hornung passed away earlier this week, which not only the golden boy of the Packers, golden boy of America for quite a while, just sad. You and I were talking offline about just how sad it is. Just, the players you admire, the era, and just how they, just one by one being taken away. And obviously, the captain being a huge Green Bay Packer fan, Paul Hornung is a huge part of that. Bart Starr last year, just kind of tough. And it made me look up just the players on that roster. And it's packed on both sides of the ball with Hall of Famers, as you would expect. The Vince Lombardi era from 59 to 67, obviously the Packers plucked him from, the New York Football Giants, that very famous, the greatest game ever played, the 58 championship, from offensive coordinator of the Packers over to head coach of the Giants to head coach of the Packers. But on that roster, the 1966 Packers, on that roster, Paul Hornung at whatever you call his position, the jack of all trades, the running back, Bart Starr, quarterback, Jim Taylor, fullback. I mean, just a beast of, carrying the ball. Forrest Gregg, tackle, probably one of the smartest players ever to lace him up, was what Lombardi said. Jerry Kramer, guard. On the other side, you had Willie Davis, defensive end. Henry Jordan, defensive tackle. Ray Nitschke, inside linebacker, just a powerhouse, Ray Nitschke. Dave Robinson, one of the smartest players, just amazing. And also just love to see, a black player that Lombardi drafted and just kind of brought into the folds, just revolutionary that way, Lombardi was. Herb Adderley at quarterback and Willie Wood. You look at that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on offense, 6 on defense, 11 of 22 players, future Hall of Famers. It's no damn wonder they won so many games, so many Super Bowls. And no one's really ever asked you this. I collect Steve Largent, Red Grange, got an inkling for Jim Thorpe. But as I read all those names off, who's your childhood hero, Captain? We've talked about 65 Philly and Topps being your favorite. Sat as a young mustachioed, Bob Swick. Who's your player that you look up to?
Well, I pulled out my album of 1964 to 67 Philadelphia cards before the show. I got it open right now. And in 1965, when I was opening up packs of Philly cards, not even understanding what a set was, I'm looking at these were the players and these were the cards in the Packers 1965 Philadelphia set. You had a team card, then you had Herb Adderley. Then you had Willie Davis, you had Boyd Dowler,
yes.
Forrest Gregg, Hornig, Henry Jordan, Tom Moore, Nitschke, Elijah Pitts, Bart, Jimmy Taylor, Willie Wood, and a play card. And I still remember, I know this Bart Starr card is the card I got in the pack because I know I had it. It's pretty worn. And I was just fascinated with the Packers for the simple reason the connection was found in Connecticut with the Packers and with the players, for lack of a better term, closeness at the time. Bob Saransky came from the Valley, and which is the Ansonia Derby area in Connecticut. It's about a good 30 minutes from where I live. It was a good half hour or two where I used to live and when I grew up. And the local paper always used to write about him and the Packers and so on and so forth. And I was always fascinated with the Packers uniforms,
yeah,
as I saw on the cards, because, again, I'm looking at black and white TV, and I have no clue what any of the colors are or anything like that. But they were also winning, and I was truly amazed by how a team could win like that. And I liked it, and I thought it was great. And, you know, it started the love affair with the Packers that I've had in my entire life, going through, you know, the great lean years from 68 all the way up until the early 90s. But at the same time, it also solidified that error from 1959 to 1967. I don't think will ever be duplicated by any team ever.
Yeah.
What the Packers did in those years, the players they had, the Hall of Famers, just an incredible, incredible piece of football history. And I always said this, I would love, if I ever had to downsize my collection, I would have no hesitation downsizing it to 1959 to 1967 Packers items up until the second Super Bowl. I would have no problem with that whatsoever. Because that is the closest to me of what I enjoy. And I do have a lot of ticket stubs and programs from that era. They're very much still in demand this day. And the history behind it is just incredible, truly incredible. But sadly, they're all passing very, very rapidly. And it's just part of life. And it's just kind of shocking to see how fast they're going. We were very fortunate to, John Spano and Jeff Payne were very fortunate to talk to Jerry Kramer and get a lot of insight for the articles we've had on him over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
And again, Jared, very close to the Forrest Gregg family.
Yep.
Also, we're close to the Leroy Caffey family. It's just amazing. Truly amazing. And how
personal, insightful articles in Gridiron, just off those you mentioned, Forrest Gregg, Jerry Kramer, I mean, just very insightful articles and just very gracious players, just allowing strangers from across the country to interview them like that. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, Jared, in fact, Jared, was, when he moved back to Colorado, was actually very close to the Gregg family and would visit on a regular occasion, and so he had a first-hand experience with Forrest, and his articles were amazing, and I'm glad we were able to capture those thoughts and memories of him, one of the greatest Packers, and one of the greater coaches that ever was involved in football, both professional and college football. Truly amazing, truly amazing. So I don't know.
We've named the rosters. We've named the rosters. Half of the 66 team went on to the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
I mean, and still, you named a few others. There's others in there who are, you know, amazing, obviously, players. Out of all those names, Horning, Starr, Taylor, Gregg, Kramer, and then on defense, Davis, Jordan, Nitschke, Robinson, Adderley, and Wood, who's the one that you – who's your Steve Largent?
Bart Starr, hands down. Bart Starr.
Hmm.
I cannot say a player who I just idolized when I was a kid. I would throw the ball in the backyard, and I would pretend that was Bart Starr thrown at being a Packer. Even though I didn't have any Packer memorabilia at that time, not understanding it, you know what I mean. So it was. It was just a kid with a beat-up jersey and an old red helmet. And I would play by myself type of thing. And I gotta mention this. There was great irony. When I was probably in sixth grade, we had like a flag football league in town. So I got to play. It was on Saturday mornings. And the great irony was I was on the Colts team. I was against the Packers team, and we played for the for the championship of that little flag football league, sixth grade kids, and we won. And I still remember to this day, it was a bitter cold afternoon. We played off the high school had like a practice field, so we played there, and we had our flags on. We all had a mishmash of jerseys or whatever, and I remember bugging my parents to buy me a sweatshirt with a number on it, and I had number 35, and it was a white jersey, a white sweatshirt with the number 35 in green lettering on it, green ink, and I wore that night and day,
It was funny. And then my mother would yell at me when I would get grass stains on or dirt stains after a game. And she said, I thought it was flag football. Why are you tagging? Why are you getting so dirty for? And I said, well, when I go down, I go down. I can't help it. And it was funny. But that came back to me, too. So, yeah, much different time.
What was it about what was it about Bart Starr that out of all of those Hall of Famers, and most people migrate to, yeah.
Class act, in my opinion. He was 100% professional at all times. He was a very soft-spoken man. He wasn't egotistical in any way, shape, or form. He played to win every game. He had a great comprehension of the game. He didn't have the greatest talent, but he overcame that and
became, to me, one of the greatest thinking man quarterbacks out there. Played when he was injured, played when he was healthy, played, you know, did whatever the team wanted him to do. And Lombardi saw in him the ability that he was willing to go the extra step and so he could be the quarterback in the long run. I never could understand, however, how he wasn't able to translate that as a coach and be successful, other than they just did not have the talent in the years he was the coach there. They had a few, you know, nice spots, nice wins, but he just couldn't duplicate it, and I really thought they could have handled his dismissal a lot smoother than what they did. And but he, you know, being the true, the ultimate professional that he was, he accepted it and he moved on.
Yeah.
And got involved. And again, the Packers of the 90s brought him back in the fold, as they did all those guys, which is what Mike Holmgren wanted. And also, you know, the entire organization wanted it. Ron Wolf wanted it. They brought him back. They brought all those guys back. And they knew that they needed them as much as the older players needed the organization. From what I've read, Starr and Brett Favre had a lot of long talks over the years, and that was very classic. And one of the last appearances of Bart Starr at Lambeau, when he was very much in a decline, he's with Favre at halftime there, and it was just a classic moment. But Starr was just, to me, great. He was great. He was the total opposite of Joe Namath. And living where I live, I got a daily dose of Joe Namath and everything he did. And I remember they used to drive my father crazy, saying, Namath did this today, he did that. You know, what's going on with this guy? He should stick with football, blah, blah, blah. But again, it was the 60s. It was the time frame, and that's it, you know. So Bart Starr was old school. Joe Namath was new school.
Yeah.
And it basically clashed. I always wondered what it would have been like to see the Jets and the Packers in a Super Bowl instead of the Colts. I always wondered what would have happened. What would have happened? But that was not meant to be. And in a way, I really felt sorry for Johnny U, who ended up, you know, losing that game and on the downturn of his career, basically, when so should have been his upturn. But again, Namath was confident, but again, Namath only had one Super Bowl ring, which is one more than a lot of guys ever have. So that's what it's all about, you know. It's amazing.
Mm. Yeah, and the Packers do an amazing job of embracing their history like no other team. I mean, we were talking about links, you know, that the Packers team put out, you know, on YouTube, one-hour shows. And I think there were five of them. I just went over the entire history of the Packers, all the way back to Curly Lambeau. I mean, and just all the way up and through. It was just incredible. And they just, I'm a closeted Packer fan. I mean, I like, you know, America's teams, except the Cowboys. I'm not a fan of the Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the Packers, you know, the Patriots, you know of the 2000s. I love dynasties, I guess, and the Packers were the first, you know, big dynasty in modern football.
Right.
I mean, so I always dug them. And just those, you know, I mean, it was funny. There was, I think, like the final one, I watched it before you did, and I was commenting on it, like, what the hell? You're not even a Packers fan. They're amazing.
Yep.
So not only do the Packers just do an amazing job of embracing their history, but, I mean, look at this, just a team steeped in, you know, excellence all under Lombardi. And there's a reason that, you know, the ultimate trophy is named after, you know, Coach Lombardi. It's just because of what he brought to the table. And it was just
and the sad part about Lombardi was I think he should have just given up the GM job and stayed as coach. And he was very fearful of financial insecurity. And I'm sure if he just told the Packers his feelings, there would have been accommodations made every which way to keep this man in Green Bay for the rest of his career. And Washington made him an offer that he could not refuse. He takes it. He lasts basically 1 year. And sadly, you know, he passes. And, you know, and again, I look at it, I'm older than when Lombardi died, obviously. And I just say to myself, can you imagine if he was healthy and how much more he could have done, A, as a coach and or as a, manager of some sort in a team or in a front office for the NFL. It's just truly, truly amazing, but it's part of the legacy of him. He was only here for a short period of time, and that was up. And he made his mark. Well, he knew, you know.
You see it all over. I mean, you know, starting with Lombardi, obviously, the natural progression is to move up the ranks, to go from coach to GM. But then it's a tough juggle. You saw it with Mike Holmgren, you know, offered the GM job and enticed out of Green Bay to Seattle. Amazing job. I mean, it's two separate jobs. I mean, focus on coaching and not, you know, worrying about HR and player salaries and stuff like that. It is the natural progression, as most seen by most coaches, I guess, is to take over the GM job. I mean, who knows? But I mean, you're right. Lombardi got bored almost, became the GM, and then decided at some point to focus on the GM, got bored again. You know, saw the Packers not performing as well as they would under his tutelage, and gets, you know, offered the coaching and GMing job at Washington and bounces. I mean, it's always tough to see your heroes, you know, put on another jersey or another helmet. I mean, seeing Lombardi on the sidelines, Redskins coaching Sonny Jurgensen is definitely one of those that you don't get used to.
And to me, you know, again, sadly, the way he passed, you know, and with the pain he had, which is basically he would have been alive today because of all the technology we have today and the advancements in medicine. He ends up dying from it. And, you know, again, that's just part of his legacy. That's, you know, he did what he had to do and then he's gone. And that's it. So it was actually a fleeing moment in professional football history, Vince Lombardi. And he will always be appreciated by Green Bay. He was appreciated by the New York Giants. He was appreciated by Army when he coached at West Point. You know, and I still remember going to see a game at Army. We saw Army and Air Force several seasons back. Went on a bus trip, and on the bus, I'm giving the lecture on Lombardi at West Point. And a lot of people on the bus didn't even realize he was a coach there. And I said, you know, you got some serious history here at the military academy here of football. It's truly amazing. And Lombardi was part of it as much as he was part of the New York football scene. And he loved New York because, you know, that's all he cared.
Yeah.
He was the king here. King in New York. So, amazing story. And then he goes to the middle of nowhere, Green Bay, and he puts Green Bay on the map.
And that's what it was all about. So that was his destiny. That was his legacy. And it'll never be forgotten in any way, shape, or form. So you got a lot of hardcore fans with regards to they still live the Lombardi years, and that's the comparison that a lot of Green Bay Packer fans like myself at my age, that's the what we compare everything by, you know, the true team spirit, the true team unification that they played as a team. What was that sweep? That sweep was a team effort.
Packers sweep.
Can't be duplicated. Can you imagine practicing that 100 times every day in practice until you were flawless?
The famous Lombardi quote, we will run this play until we know it in our sleep, and we will run it on the field until the other team figures out how to stop it. I mean, it
and
is.
If you,
I mean,
and if
you got,
look at
when you're handing the ball off to Paul Hornung or Jim Taylor, and you've got Jerry Kramer pulling, you know, to block in front of you, I mean, good luck. Yeah.
Yep. And if you actually look at old films of that play unfolding, it's just, to me, so poetic. It's just not even funny. It's just something. If I was a coach today in the NFL, I would force my whole team to watch that over and over again, and to say this is what teamwork is. This is how you win games. This is it. You know, 1 yard at a time, one score at a time. That's what it's all about.
And then the stuff that Packer team wasn't known for. I mean, the color barrier. I mean, you know, drafting not black or white, but Packer green. Drafting players for who they are. Dave Robinson. I mean, you know, speaks. You know, in that Packer. Video in those Packers videos. I mean, spoke so highly of him. And who was it? It was Jerry Kramer that was saying. You know, he had. You know, just how interesting it was to be roomed up with a black player in that era. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so a lot more about it. You know, a lot more to him than just the on the field.
Right. And again, Lombardi also treated the players' wives very graciously. At the end of the season, he would buy them mink stoles. He'd buy pennants and rings for them. You know, he treated everybody was family to him. That was his family, and that was the strongest part about Lombardi. Quick story: when we were out in Green Bay, it had to have been 2008. First night we were there, we went to Lombardi's, the restaurant, which is in Appleton.
Yeah,
and I ended up getting lost on the way out there at a rental car. And again, that's, it was pre-Google Map Day type of thing. So we're trying to figure out, we got directions, we're getting there. We finally get there, and they were very nice. We were a little late. They said, no problem, we'll have your table, blah, blah, blah. And it was just so funny. They were playing the Falcons that weekend, and we walk in, and our table is like directly across from the Falcons coaching table there. And a couple players walked in, they were having dinner there, and it was very nonchalant. I'm not the type to Google anybody or go up to anybody to say, grab your autograph or whatever. I just thought it was just so cool. Here I am at Lombardi's. I don't see one Packer person, but I see literally the entire Atlanta Falcons team here. It was funny. It was truly funny. And then the next day.
Good homage.
Game day. We had flown out a couple of days early. Game day, we're at Brett Favre's steakhouse for the pregame. We were given tickets for it. And I'm in line with two Falcon guys right behind me. I can't catch a break. But those guys were very, very nice. They were very cool. And we had a nice conversation waiting in line to get in there. And again, the game day experience at Lambeau is unsurpassed anywhere. And you have to, if you go there, you have to go to the Packer Hall of Fame because it is just an incredible display of history of the Packers.
Oh, Lambeau Field is Mecca for football. I mean, can you think of another stadium with that kind of storied history? I mean, most stadiums have been, built and torn down and rebuilt again. But Packer, Lambeau is, it's the original.
Yep. It's just incredible. And one time we stayed out there, we stayed at a B&B in downtown Green Bay. And the stadium is basically in the residential part of Green Bay, which is like more of a residential than you go to, a lot of, for lack of a better term, like a Route 1 where there's, shopping malls, plazas, things of that nature. And that time, we decided to walk into Green Bay that night. It was a nice night. We took a walk. We were going to find a place to eat. Brenda and I were the only people on the street. And we were saying, is this the Twilight Zone? Or you know, where is everybody? There's no one here. There's nothing going on anywhere. What's wrong here? And so we walked by the church Lombardi used to go to on a daily basis. And then we're saying, I really hope something's open. You know, we got to eat. And then luckily, we're like two blocks down. It started to blow and the restaurant's open. And it was pretty funny. So I commented to the hostess at the restaurant. I said, Is this normally like this? She said, yeah, the night before game day, it's a different vibe here downtown. But she said, tomorrow it'll be back to normal. I said, well, wow, that's unbelievable. And that game, the guy I got tickets from, who is actually a longtime subscriber to Gridiron Greats, John Espen, he said to me, you're going to park. He gave me directions to this person's house because a lot of people rent their yard out to park. So we parked there. It was $20 to park on her yard, and she makes a pregame meal. So you go in and you leave a donation. She had brats, beer, you name it. She had everything. So she's saying to us after the game, come back in, use the bathroom. I'll have more food out. Just close the door on the way out, and you'll be all set. And we're like laughing our heads off, saying, could you imagine this at the Meadowlands in New York? It's impossible.
Yeah,
it would never happen in
Pittsburgh.
Never happened.
That is amazing hospitality. I love it. Wow.
It's just, you know, complete strangers. And, you know, we're talking to her like long-lost friends. And, you know, she's asking them, you know, I can't believe you guys came out from Connecticut, blah, blah, blah. Can't believe you know John that well, blah, blah, blah. It was amazing. One of the times we were out there, too, Fuzzy Thurston was still alive. So after the game, we went to Fuzzy's, which was a bar and grill outside of Green Bay, and we go in there, and it's like a dive bar when you walk into the place. It was actually pretty cool, and I you know, Mr. Naive there, I said, is Fuzzy there? Said, yeah, yeah, go in the back of the room. He's there. He'll take pictures with him or whatever, and he talked with the voice piece because he lost his voice, and I still got the picture of him with his arm around me with the fort with the three rings in front of my face, squeezing me. I mean, the man had like a bear hug at his age, and he was another one, where are you from? And he said, Wallingford, Connecticut. And he said, I can't believe you're all the way from Connecticut. He said, Packer fans are everywhere in the world. And such a cool experience to meet him in person and talk to him. So great memories of the Green Bay. And Green Bay Airport
Good
is
on.
Very small. It's a tiny airport. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool. But anyways, great memories.
Well,
great memories. Of the Pack.
Again, my condolences, Captain. I mean, another Packer great passing.
I know.
Seahawks started in 1976. So I've got a ways to go before I have to start, you know, worrying about some of my childhood heroes passing.
Yep, exactly. Well, let's move on to a few more subjects here. And again, if you don't subscribe to Gridiron Greats, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com. I got a comment on, I think we should start making this a regular on the show, just do a little blurb, the eBay sighting of the week. Of an incredible football item that how you can even comprehend you would list it the way you're listing it is beyond me. And the award this week goes to a dealer who has a 1991 Pro Set, number one Emmett Smith card in PSA 10 with a buy it now of a mere $12,000, or you could start the auction off at $7,500. $12,000 by now. If you got a spare $7,500, bid on it.
You know, I'm sure for that amount of money, you could have Emmett fly to your house, you know, for your birthday party. It's I'm one of those idiots. I looked up how much Steve Largent's speaking fee was once, just out of curiosity. it's $10,000 plus expenses. So we joke around that one of these days I'm just going to splurge on it and held it. Let's just bring Largent on out and put him up in a hotel, and he has to fly first class. He has to be put up in a nice hotel, and you're paying all the expenses. So call it $13K, maybe $14K, and you've got Steve Largent for, 3 or 4 hours. Come to a birthday party, a bar mitzvah, whatever you want. Just let's go watch a movie. Let's go watch a movie, Steve. Whatever it is. I just out of curiosity, I looked it up once. So anyway.
Unbelievable.
Kind of interesting. That's funny. Did you bid on it or are you just watching it, Bob?
No, I think I'll pass,
I know how you like your slab BSA 10 cards.
I will rationally assume you could probably pick up that card for maybe $20 or $25 at the most. So I just can't see why somebody would pay that, and I don't know if the guy's doing it as a joke or whatever, or if he really seriously thinks so. That's what it's worth type of thing. So who knows? This is ridiculous.
What were you looking for when you stumbled across that little gem, Captain?
Well, I was just, I do random searches, and, I for whatever reason, I stumbled across it, and then we saw on VFC they had posted it also, and I thought that was funny, because I was looking at it before, and then I saw it posted, and I said, oh, you got to be, it's just amazing, it's just truly amazing. There's certain things on eBay that I see somebody trying to sell just it defies logic of any sort. And I just don't believe it ever sells. You know what I mean? So why are you wasting everybody's time with it and wasting the listing? Well, it's free listing. So why are you...
You see a lot more of this crap. Yeah, you nailed it. Free listings. You see a lot more of this crap nowadays than you did in the past. Because if you were listing, a $150 card for, for $7,000 and it cost you $14 to list it, it costs you $100 to list it for $7,500, then you'd reel it in, and you wouldn't put all this crap up. But I forget when they did away with listing fees. Obviously to facilitate more listings, but you start seeing a lot more trash now. I agree.
It's just comical. Yeah, it reminds me of a guy, and I know he was legitimately trying to sell his collection. He was at the Cleveland National. And he literally had every Browns card ever printed. And he had it beautifully displayed in all sheets and in binders. And he was telling me, he says, I really would like to sell this as a complete collection. And I said to him, man, you put out a lot of money to set up here. Wouldn't you think it would make more sense for you to try to, people want one set or whatever, I'm looking for a 58-team set or whatever, sell it that way. He says, no, I want to sell it as is in the binders and the sheets. I'll throw in the bookcases I brought here and everything. And I don't know if he ever did or not, but it was just fascinating to watch. He perfectly displayed everything, had everything in nice and sheets and everything. But, is there really a market for that like that at a show like that? I don't know.
If someone's setting up, and they've earned the right to do that. So I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. He's paid his price, and I thoroughly enjoyed looking at everything. I thought it was great. I wished him well. Some Browns fan with the deep pocket, they got an incredible collection there, or a dealer in the Cleveland area who deals in Browns, you got a great investment there. So whatever.
Showdog.
So I had to get in our eBay, believe it or not, I don't know how to describe it, but believe it or not, eBay sighting that you cannot
It'll become just as much of a staple of the show as Joe's quizzes after guests.
Exactly.
Shoot for it. But yeah, wanted to talk about a couple of auctions. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's get into a few of these auctions that we were talking about before.
Yeah. I think a couple shows ago I was talking about a little, auction desert going on right now. It just seemed like, our summer auctions ended and there was just this long desert of just nothing. And I love auctions. I love, if you know, if there's nine auctions firing off, you know, or, you know, going at once, and there's three things I'm watching, that's amazing to me. I love that. I love choices. So I always miss it when there's a desert of auctions. So we have a bunch of auctions that opened and some coming up. You know, Leland's, we've obviously had him on the show before. His auction opened on November 11th. Some really good stuff in there. Some complete sets, 50 Bowman all the way up to 55 Bowman. Some of them move around.
Yep, I saw that.
Some really good stuff. And it just, you know, Leland's always good for some good stuff. Love of the Game, advertiser of Gridiron Greats, Al Crisafulli, his auction fired off. I was looking at it earlier. He's got some really nice 35 Chickles that are, you know, listed, as well as one of my favorite sets, a 48 Leaf PSA 8 Bill Dudley. That's beautiful, nicely centered. Just some really good, you know, some good offerings in Love of the Game. And then we have three auctions that are firing off here in the next week. November 19th, Heritage Sports. And they it seems like they've always got a revolving auction. It's confusing sometimes. Mile High fires off on November 23rd, which Mile High surprises you. They're a little shocker. It reminds me a lot of Huggins. You know, for some reason, I've got a lot of my really rare esoteric things out of Huggins, but Mile High always reminds me of that. They surprise you. And then the Daddy, we've had Brian Dwyer on the show before, REA, fires off on November 20th. And I keep hoping, that's 2 days from now, I keep hoping somebody opens up a back door, you know, so we can get in and check out what's going on at REA. But always some good high-end football offerings in Robert Edwards. So some good shows, some good auctions coming up. So I feel excited. I feel giddy. Just we're coming into auction season, Captain. Looking forward to it.
It's interesting to see the offerings, and I'm going to make a comment on Al's Love of the Game interactive catalog that he has online. Really cool. If you subscribe to his auctions, he sends you a email to get into the catalog before you either A, receive it in the mail and or you know, it opens. And real cool to go through to see online the actual catalog and to what's being offered, so on and so forth. So I got to give hats off to Al and
all the way down to the little details. The little detail, when you click on the page to move it, you can hear the sound of a page moving. That cracks me up every time. So I love it.
It's very, very interesting. And I did say to Al not the last national, the one before, I said, you can't give up on a printed catalog because there's too many guys out there, old timers, who want the paper, want the catalog in front of them. They're not computer guys. And they thoroughly enjoy getting the catalog and looking at it and holding on to it. And a lot of these same guys are subscribers to Gridiron Greats. I mean, they tell me all the time, please don't go to an online format. I want the real magazine in my hands. And, you know, I understand that. I hear what they're saying. You know, I prefer paper myself. I prefer the physical book, you know, the physical catalog, so on and so forth. The Packers this year, because obviously you can't go to the game, they're sending an interactive program with the day before the game. So the actual printed program, you can view it online. So that's pretty unique. But like I said to myself, I still want the program in my hand. You know what I mean? To look at and to read rather than reading it online. Yeah. But, you know, it's nice they're doing that, at least realizing that you can't go to a game, you can't see anything, but at least you got it. So.
I also try and be cognizant of cost. I mean, because, you know, Al and I were, I think John and I were talking about that once too, Spano. Is just the cost it takes to, you know, I mean, obviously the pictures have to be taken, you know, the descriptions have to be written, all that has to be done. But then once that's done, it's collating it to pages, it's sending it off to a printer, it's printing it, it's packaging it, and it's shipping them. You know, you're familiar with that, you know, as the publisher of Gridiron Greats. But I mean, you know, it is a massive cost, you know.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I like the format that somebody uses where, like, if you opt out of receiving a printed catalog, you'll get, $20 off your shipping or something like that. Good alternatives. But still, if you're shipping, $600 catalogs versus $300, you've got to send it to the printer. The printer's got to set it up.
Well, coming from a printing background, No, I was going to say, coming from a printing background, it is a lot of work, and the cost of mailing today is skyrocketing. So it is a definite savings for the auction houses, to say the least. And that's a good idea. Give somebody a credit, free shipping or whatever it is, if they opt out of it. So
I agree with that.
Yes. I know most of America thinks it never rains in Portland, but man, it just started raining. I mean, hard to the point where it drowned out the sound of your voice. And it lasted about 45 seconds and just ended. That's Portland.
Yep, I hear you.
All right, so we've got some good auctions coming up. It'll be interesting. We'll be talking about them down the road also. Real quick comment from the latest issue of the magazine. I got a lot of comments on Jeff Payne's article on the 67 Williams portraits, and I also got several comments on Dr. Bob Stevenson's article on the Browns cards, which is something I had one reader send
really
me an email,
article.
And he basically said, I can't believe that was the same photo they used. And I said, yeah. And I said, a lot of people don't realize that. But I heard about it quite a few years ago, and I never could understand it. Bob did a nice job writing about it and informing the readers about it and the information with regards to it. But that was very common back then, just, take whatever they had laying around, and that's going to be their, that's the card, that's the photo for the card. And that's it. It's amazing.
And reusing it, reusing cards over and over, touching them up. Yeah, little stuff. But yeah, some really good articles. Thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, just some very good articles in the latest, Gridiron Grid.
And the
Williams
portrait was by far the most intensive analysis of that set ever written. And I got to compliment Jeff on it. That was a great article. We got a lot of nice comments on it, to say the least. But I just want to point that out and point out on those Browns cards too, which again reminds me of the National at Cleveland those two times and the different Brown fans I talked to there, and it's very interesting, to say the least. All right, what else we got on our agenda here? We did our eBay sightings, our auctions, talked about the Packers. What else we got?
Boy, but it's funny. You and I talk so much offline. Sometimes just the show is a continuation of that. What else we got here?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, call it. I'm literally standing at my desk, and I was looking at Love of the Games. I was scrolling through that. Let's see here. What is some?
The other thing that I wanted to comment on. Again, I had a nice conversation with a longtime local collector. We were talking about publications. I've been trying to help him sell some of his publications. He just doesn't collect football. He collected all sports. And it kind of reminded me of me that, I always enjoyed back in the 60s. I would buy sports magazines. I had a subscription to the Sporting News, Sports Illustrated, when it was a real, real magazine of value, the old sport magazine, and so on and so forth. And I just don't understand, in a way, why there isn't there is a demand, but yet there isn't a demand for publications. And I clarify that by saying I know a lot of team collectors enjoy collecting the media guide programs, any magazine that has a cover of the their favorite player. If they're, for example, go back to the Browns, if they're a Browns collector, they'll collect anything that has Jimmy Brown on it or anything that has Brian Sipe on it, whatever, that type of situation. But I'm fascinated seeing why there isn't a greater demand for publications. And he brought up a good point. He says he really thinks because a lot of people don't have room or whatever, they don't want to have like a couple hundred publications, you know, laying around. And I argue that, you know, basically that's one bookcase. You know what I mean? You could have a small bookcase and you could put your publications in it, and you're reading history at all times, especially when you look at media guides. So I'm just fascinated with that area that there's that greater demand. Obviously, I could be wrong, but hopefully in the future, collectors, especially those who started collected in the 70s and 80s and then stopped and now they get going back into it, they start looking at the publications of that time frame and say to themselves, hey, this is a nice part, a nice addition to my collection, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Whatever they're collecting.
And I just ordered some pre-Bob Swick, Swick Enterprises Gridiron Greats. I picked up subscribing to Gridiron Greats in about 2009 when you and I met on a on a chat board, and I'd never heard of Gridiron Greats before that. But the minute you know it was announced that you bought it, I was like, well, let me check this out. You know, any previous, you know, any pre-Swick Enterprises copies of Gridiron, I've never read. Except when somebody will post up like an article of it in a reference or something like that. Somebody, so I think there's like 13, how many, you would probably know, how many Gridiron Greats, you know, magazines are there pre-Swick Enterprises?
Okay, so there's issues number 1 to 22. We started at issue 23. And issues 1, 2, 3, and 4 are exceptionally rare. They don't come to market very often. Numbers 1 and 2, very, very, almost literally impossible to find in the market. So it's a difficult buy, to say the least.
So somebody was selling, I want to say, like, you know, numbered, you know, 7 through 21 or something like that. So I just had 11 or 12 episodes of Gridiron Greats delivered to my house. And somebody, they did a really nice job wrapping it in bubble wrap and stuff. It kind of made me laugh that, you know, they wrapped magazines in bubble wrap. So they are sitting on my end table of my couch. And I got them yesterday, like I said, unwrapped them. I plan on starting to read, you know, pre-Swick Enterprises Gridiron Greats. But I'm kind of a minimalist. I don't like packing. You know, I kind of scaled my collection down, you know, 5-6 years ago. And I used to keep, auction catalogs and stuff. So I went through and kind of threw those out. You know, I might save an entire catalog just because there's one thing I bought in there. So I went through and, you know, pulled those pages out, threw a lot of stuff away. The one thing that I kept was every Gridiron Great magazine that I have, sitting on my in my bookcase. So,
and I gotta say this now: we are very literally down to only one or two copies of the USFL cover, the American Football League cover, and the three issues that John Spano wrote. The articles on the Mayos. So some of the early issues now that we printed are very much in low supply. So again, you know, people looking at this stuff, people, you know, if you want to fill your run in, I highly suggest, you know, see them at auction or whatever, pick them up. And again, issues 1 to 22 are very difficult to find. So, those are going to be more difficult and tough to have a complete run. So it's kind of interesting. It's almost like a cult magazine following. You know, it's very interesting to see. And I'm very proud of the way the magazine progressed from when we took it over in issue 23 up to our last issue, which was number 70. So it's been a long time. We went to color. We went to first class mailing. We did everything we could to try to improve the magazine. But again, I can't do it without our writers and without our subscribers. I appreciate and I thank you.
Without our senior
for all
contributing writers as well.
That's true. Just not but, everyone can be called that.
But it was
only a select few.
But probably like 5-6 years ago, I went through and reread most of my Gridiron Greats. And then I had a little sticky note, you know, a little group of sticky notes. And I went through and put sticky notes, you know, with little flags sticking out of all the good articles. And I've forgotten. I think the first article I ever wrote for you was 1984 Tops. It was a 25.
Yep.
It would have been in 2009 because it was a 25-year anniversary of it. And
I remember that
so much fun. So much fun writing that. I learned so much about the set just by doing the research on it. Like, you know, just how the sheets were labeled, you know, A, B, C, D in that instance. And I just learned a lot. And I wanted it to be perfect in the pictures and stuff. And I think a lot of people have trepidation about writing an article for Gridiron because, you know, they're afraid. But, man, you can write on anything. You can write on anything that you collect, on anything that you find fascinating in the hobby. And that's what I love about Gridiron is it's about sharing your knowledge with the rest of us.
And I think that the nice part about the magazine is we've basically have given a spot for the football card and memorabilia collector who, you know, and I hate to come right out and say it, we're shunned for many years until the football card explosion of 1989-1990, and still kind of shunned because there was really never any, you know, dedicated publication out there. You know, I don't call Beckett Football Monthly or even Tough Stuff at the time being dedicated to collectors. Yeah, Sports Collectors, the old Sports Collectors Digest, did, you know, write a lot about football cards, collectors, things of that nature, but still wasn't dedicated. You were still reading about the other collectors in the other sports. So it's kind of, you know, it's a niche publication, and it has a very strong following. And, you know, again, I'll never be People Magazine, nor do I want to be. But at the same time, I think we've done a great contribution to the hobby over the years, and, you know, we're still at it. So I'm proud of it, to say the least. And, my right-hand person, my wife, laying it out every issue, it's a big task. It's not something we throw together in, you know, in 20 minutes and then, you know, we bring it to the printer. We spend a lot of time on this, putting it together and making sure, you know, we're at 100% with everything. And, it's a lot of work, to say the least. But we enjoy it.
Yeah. My wife has a journalism degree. And I let her read one once. I think on the 57 Tops article. And I love dramatic pauses for commas and stuff like that. And I love sprinkling humor in there, as people can tell. But I let her read it. And she just started tearing it apart, like moving stuff, and this doesn't make any sense. And I'm thankful that I saved a copy because I basically learned my lesson of asking her to help. We went to a Seahawk game, and I was telling her about when I was writing on the pencils, the football pencils. And she's the one who came up with the title for that, Gridiron Graphite, which made me laugh. It was perfect. And she's like, so do I get a proofread it? I'm like, hell no. So my lesson is these articles want to be, you know, they want to be cheeky. They want to be fun. We're here to pass on. That's why I started, you know, that little series I had, the silly things we collect, just because there are so many silly things that we collect that are just important to us. Yeah. I mean, if you bring this up at Thanksgiving, like, hey, you want to see a Red Grange, you know, 7 foot long banner that, you know, was used in the 50s to advertise, for ExxonMobil, you know, college games. I mean, people think you're crazy, but it's fascinating to us. The best way to scratch that itch is to share it with people. I don't know. So if you're thinking about writing an article for Gridiron and you're afraid to because you want it to be perfect, don't. I've even sent scratch articles off to Bob and a few other friends and said, what do you think? And gotten input from people, just made minor adjustments. So,
Well, Joe, we're literally out of time. We got 30 seconds, 5-second wrap up, if any.
Yeah. I like these shows. I say it 100 times, best seat in the house, Captain. So So this show just literally just kind of whipped by just because you and I talk all the time about football and on our chat boards, our vintage football chat board that Jeff Payne has. So another great day, another great show. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Joe, and we're out of time. We'll be back hopefully in a week or two with another show. Thanks for listening.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.